We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with David Kerp. He's from the Goldman School of Public Policy at University of California, Berkeley. He's a professor, former acting dean at the Goldman School, somebody who has been working on education policy on all levels, preschool through college, for a long time. And he says that he wanted to write a book that would try to pull all of this together. And he started out with a very long list of ideas, narrowing them down to five that he thought were big, game-changing, affordable strategies supporting kids from crib to college. And the result is his book, Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. Public Affairs is the publisher on the book. It's out now if you'd like to take a look at it. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, David Kerp. He served on President Obama's transition team in 2008. Before that, he taught at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He was the founding director of the Harvard Center on Law and Education, former associate editor of the Sacramento Bee, and a syndicated columnist. He now writes for publications including the New York Times, the LA Times, American Prospect, The Nation. He also consults with leading national and state organizations. And he's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions are welcome, as always. We do, however, ask people who call in to try and be brief so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many people as possible. But certainly your calls are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. And you can send us an email as well if you'd like to send your comments along that way. And the address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So at any point here in the conversation, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. And Professor Kerp, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. It seems that we are at a very difficult time here for families, at least in this respect, that while we continue to say that families and their needs are important, that education is important, now the kinds of decisions that we are talking about making when it comes to spending, both on the state level and on the federal level, seem to target most those things that should be the most important. Programs that most affect families and children. And frankly, I guess as I look at it, I find it fairly discouraging, and I wonder how you feel about it.
Oh, it's terribly discouraging. I mean, you seem now to be the, Illinois seems to be the home of refugees, only in this case it's refugees from Wisconsin. You know, fighting over you know, pretty basic rights for kids. We're not talking about anything elaborate or new. We're talking about even maintaining schools at decent size and giving kids any shot at early educational opportunities, an area in which, by the way, Illinois is one of the national pioneers.
Well, why is it that while on the one hand, I think that people are attached to their local schools, and I think at some level recognize that schools are important, and yet they come in for such disrespect, and teachers, I'm really, really distressed that there seems now, and it's definitely connected with what's going on in Wisconsin, in Indiana, and other places, this struggle between state government and the workers that represent people like teachers. But it just seems that there's heaps of scorn and abuse being piled on teachers, people who do a very important job. And I guess I also find that pretty distressing.
It is distressing. I've been spending a lot of time this year hanging out in a poor urban Latino school district just outside of New York City. And there the teachers are a little short of miracle workers. I mean, what they're accomplishing with kids who come to school not speaking English and, you know, from families with limited educational background is remarkable. And they're in the morning at 7 a.m., you know, they may be leaving at 3 or 4, but they're taking work home. They're working on weekends. It's a tough, important job. And I've no doubt that teachers, like everybody else, need to sacrifice in these economic tough times. But the notion of demonizing teachers just seems to be short-sighted and, you know, the most cynical political calculation. Fortunately, the voters, at least when you ask them, when pollsters ask them, aren't buying it. I mean, they still hold teachers in high regard. But that message hasn't gotten through to the politicians who think that they can make hay by teacher bashing.
Yeah. Well, then maybe it gets us to a question about an exercise like Kids First. And I think, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and we talk with a lot of people who make recommendations about dealing with important social policy issues. And I think probably the area in which we have spent the most time generally has to do with families and their needs, and fairly specifically has to do with public education. And so we have these conversations and we talk about what ought to be done, and then we just go on to the next conversation. And I can't really point to anything, not that I would think that this program should make very much difference, but it can't really point to very much that has happened over the last decade or so in terms of school reform that has advanced things very much, in spite of the fact that I think that a lot of people have talked about a lot of really good ideas.
Well, I think that's a little unfair. It's a little unfair to your home state, for starters. The big development, and it's one that I spend a lot of time talking about in Kids First, is the emergence of early education, something that's become almost taken for granted part of the landscape. The states, you know, increased by about threefold the amount of money that they spent on early education. And even last year, during the big budget cuts, those dollars remained intact. So we have substantial numbers of four-year-olds going to early education and increasing numbers of three-year-olds. And I think politically, you know, the old conservative idea that this was the nanny state, that this was, you know, cradle robbing of kids, that this is what moms ought to be doing and not government, that's almost gone. Just sort of gone for two reasons, because people get the idea of how important early education is for kids, not just in developing their abilities to do, you know, to read, to say the alphabet and to know their numbers, but also to be able to work and play well with others, to be able to sort of control their own emotions, to stay in line, to clean up after themselves, to even if you go into a good preschool, to sort of watch them serving each other at lunch. And all that may sound kind of frilly, but it turns out we know down the road, from research done by University of Chicago economist Jim Heckman, that those kinds of measures, the measures of sort of emotional togetherness, have huge long-term payoffs in terms of things like rates of pregnancy, drug abuse, alcohol use, juvenile delinquency, and the like. So it's important stuff, and I think parents have recognized it. They understand something about brain development. More and more lawmakers have got that notion, and again, it's an area in which Illinois has played a leading role. Mm-hmm. And the other, you know, strange to say, the other is No Child Left Behind, because what people seem to forget about No Child Left Behind, for all of its problems, and I'm hardly a fan of the system as it operates now, but for all of its problems, it was the one piece of bipartisan legislation adopted during the George Bush era, the one piece of bipartisan domestic legislation. Its major sponsor in Congress was that notorious right-winger, Senator Kennedy. The reason for that is pretty clear. It was the goal is to end what George Bush, in the best line a speechwriter ever penned for him, called the soft bigotry of low expectations. And again, for all of its problems, I think that the push to pay attention to the kids who are doing worst in the society is an important one. Has it worked? No. Does it need lots of change? Yes. But that shift in emphasis away from the, oh, we can't expect anything of those kids, to something, you know, which say, to a message that we really have to try harder, we really have to rework what we're doing, is important. So I actually think it's been a very exciting year. The other thing that's happened is that, you know, lots of money was poured into states, particularly those that were willing to engage in pretty basic reforms aimed at improving their education systems. And it looks like, despite, you know, the current budget crises, you've got an 11% increase in education programs proposed by the president, and you've got a chunk of money going to early education proposed by the president. And for those things, you know, there isn't the same knee-jerk opposition. There is even, even among many Republicans, there is a recognition of the importance of focusing on early education. Other things are very much up for grabs, and of course, until we deal with the big entitlement programs, Social Security and particularly Medicare, the big changes aren't going to happen. But you know, these are more than little adjustments over the last decade.
Mm. Well, our guest in this hour of Focus is David Kirp. He is professor and former acting dean at the Goldman School of Public Policy at University of California, Berkeley, someone well known for writing about educational policy. He is the author of a recently published book. The title of his book is Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. Public Affairs Books is the publisher. One of the five ideas, something that he has touched on here, and that is high-quality early education. And we'll talk about some of the others, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, as far as early education is concerned, what you're saying is that we certainly know how to do it, and we know what constitutes a good program. Is just the big issue here what we can do to make it more widely available so that any child can have access?
That is the big issue, and the big issue is making sure that we maintain standards of quality, because throughout the book, which, you know, as you noted, really doesn't focus on how you reform schools, and in part for just the reasons that you were suggesting. It's an endless debate, and often a frustrating one. I mean, it focuses really on pillars of support for kids from parenting up through college. But you know, we know it works, but we often don't do what works because we often pinch pennies. So, for example, there is a program in Chicago called the Parent Child Centers. That's one of the few, maybe the only big early education program that's shown over a long period of time to make a difference, to affect kids well into their 20s and 30s, remarkably so. And it increasingly has been starved for funds by the Chicago schools. I think it's a very short-sighted decision that they've made. And again, you know, you're in a state which is a national leader in terms of the effectiveness of its children's lobby. Across the country, though, it's been tougher to persuade politicians that they should fund really good preschools. So they should fund more preschools, so that even as the dollars have not been cut, the number of kids have been increased, which means that less and less is being spent per child. And that's problematic, because we do know that small classes make a difference. We know the well-trained teachers make a difference. We know there are some curricula that have been proved to work well in terms of getting kids ready for kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And it's essential that we really pay attention to quality and not just to the numbers.
And I'm just going back to this interesting idea about that you touched on, and that is what goes on here. And I suppose one might first ask the question, is there teaching and learning going on? And I think that probably you would say, well, actually there is. Then the question is, well, what? And are they skills that we think children need to have really before a more formal kind of teaching and learning starts to go on, the kind of thing that maybe we think starts in kindergarten and perhaps then more so once we get into first grade?
You know, I wish everybody would have a chance to go into a preschool and watch what's happening, because too many people, and particularly too many politicians, think, oh, it's just babysitting.
Yeah.
You know, real learning begins when kids are five. Well, in fact, by the time kids are five, so much has already gone on that schools really have their work cut out for them. By the time children are 4 years old, the children of professional families have heard 30 million more words spoken to them than children from welfare families. And those children from professional families have a bigger vocabulary than the welfare moms. So that means unless kids can be exposed to a world that is really word-soaked and activity-soaked, they come to school behind the eight ball. And it's not just play. People talk about little kids as sponges, you know, that just absorb knowledge, or as glasses that are sort of filling the glasses with water. Their brains are just being sort of packed with knowledge. I think it's a bad image. I think kids really are little explorers. They're little Lewis's and Clark's. And if you watch what goes on in one of those classes, it's the best teaching that I know You know, I have it easy. I'm a university professor. I get decently paid, and I'm teaching highly motivated students a relatively limited amount of time. Here you've got folks who are constantly on the go. There are activities going on every second. There's a, you know, academics talk about teachable moments. Well, there's a teachable moment every minute in those places. And you watch the learning. It's really visible to see what it is that's happening. And this isn't just, you know, great for poor kids. Middle-class kids come to kindergarten as far behind academically, as far behind rich kids as poor kids come to school behind middle-class kids. So there's lots of value in the academic side of preschool, and there's also lots of value in this. But you know, when I was in school, it used to be called, you know, works and plays well together activities. Learning to cooperate, learning to collaborate, learning to wait your turn. Learning how to control, you know, tantrums and being able to talk about things instead of acting out. That's crucial to kids. And it's not going to happen these days in kindergarten because kindergarten has depressingly become an academic experience. What we used to think of as first and even second grade is now going on in kindergarten as the pressure to do well in math and reading and writing that sets in elementary school has pushed down, forcing higher academic standards on kindergarten. So kindergarten looks much more like school and much less like what it used to look like. And all those kind of basic activities, all those crucial activities about the foundations of learning, the exposure to the richness of language, you know, the ability to learn how to be well, to do well with others, you know, that's all preschool's mission these days.
Well, then, does that mean that what we're really talking about is should we be talking about formalizing pre-K and actually saying, well, it used to be that we said that your public education experience started with kindergarten. We expect all kids to be there and show up and start on that day, and then they're going to go forward. Well, now what we're going to do is we're just going to back it up 1 year or 2 years or however long we think that we need to do it and institutionalize that and make that all part of the system and have, instead of now have all the kids show up ready to go for kindergarten, we're going to say, well, now we're saying we're expecting to see you at 3 or 4, and the whole deal is going to start 2 years earlier.
You know, as I say in Kids First, you know, the family is really the first schoolhouse, and parents are kids' most important educators. And I trust parents to make smart decisions for their kids, and not just, you know, in the parenting role, not just in early education, but all the way through. So every stage in the Kids First agenda is really infused with a powerful role for parents. So I wouldn't want to say, you know, parents, we're now making, you know, kindergarten and preschool compulsory. But I am saying that you really want to expose parents to all of what we know about how important preschool is and let them make that decision. Now there are some parents who, you know, have the time and the inclination to stay home with their kids before they go to school. That's wonderful. But even for those parents, there's lots that their kids are going to learn, both in terms of activities and in terms of being able to connect with other children. That means that, I mean, if I were one of those parents and I could stay home with my child, I'd do it, but I'd also send my child to school at least part day so that they'd get that complimentary experience. I think when parents know, you know, what's happening and why it matters, all parents want what's best for their children, and they'll figure it out. That's what's happened in places where serious educational campaigns have been run. It's not, you know, big state says, you've got to go to preschool. It is, let's show you what's going on, and you, parents, make up your mind.
We started here with your number two of your five big ideas. We sort of jumped right to early childhood education. Let's step back just for a second, because that's where we are going here, because your argument is that we really need to provide support for new parents, and that as you rightly say, that's really where education, maybe it's not formal, but that's really where education begins.
Absolutely. I mean, we used to think that when kids were born, you know, their brains were fixed. You know, that's the old IQ argument. You've got the intelligence is something that's known at birth and it's not going to change. We know from so many different kinds of studies, including neurological studies, genetic studies, that that's entirely wrong. That children's brains are so plastic. They're plastic. They develop also, you know, during the time of gestation, so that if you can encourage moms to lead a relatively stress-free life, to not do the kinds, engage in the kinds of activities that are going to be potentially damaging to the fetus. That's really important. But, you know, from the time they're born, there's so many skills that the child is learning all the time. There's nobody more inquisitive than an infant and a toddler. And, you know, parents, I don't know a parent who doesn't turn to somebody at some time and say, I've got this problem with my kid. She's not sleeping. He's not eating. You know, he's, you know, seems to be screaming all the time. He's angry. He's whatever. And they talk to somebody about that. They talk to their, you know, to their own moms, or they talk to the minister or the social worker or the clinician or the pediatrician or whoever. And getting the kind of information to those families, it makes good parenting advice as taken for granted as well baby checkups. That's my hope as to how the process would begin, because that's what really lays a solid foundation for kids to have the fullest lives that they can have.
So you're not talking about some more formal way to get parent education into schools or some kind of programs that people would attend. You're talking about having informational resources available so that when people have the question, then they know who they can call.
Again, I'm a big believer in giving people information and inviting them to act on it. So that, you know, there are two kinds of programs that support parents. One are home visiting programs, which, as they say, you've got somebody. It could be a nurse, it could be a teacher, it could be a paraprofessional, who goes into families' houses, parents' houses, and works with mom or mom and dad and the kids. And for some families, that's exactly what they need. It's exactly what they want. So that, you know, for example, programs that encourage parents to read to their kids, to take their kids to the grocery store and, you know, show them what it is that they do. How do they pick the things that they pick off the shelves? That talk about what it is the children are watching, that get the parents to actually talk to their children. Those are really important activities. They're going to be necessarily limited in scope, but they're really important activities. The other kind of effort, one that's less well known in this country but really powerful, are efforts to give all those people I was describing, all those professionals, the pediatricians and the nursery school teachers and the social workers and the ministers, a kind of evidence-based skill set that allows them to really help parents when they come in. And I've talked to social workers and I've talked to ministers who said, you know, I'm so grateful for that kind of training. And the program that does it is one that's called Triple P, the Positive Parenting Program. I'm so grateful for that information. And, you know, in study after study, it's been shown to have huge effects, not just for individual parents, but for large areas. So that in Australia, for example, you know, the comparison was between two of the biggest cities in the country, including Sydney. You know, looking at effects on a variety of factors, everything from children being abused or neglected on the one hand, to children being ready for school on the other hand. And they work. They've been shown to work in a big study that the Centers for Disease Control sponsored in 22 counties in South Carolina, where you had, you know, again, big demonstrable effects on the ways in which parents raise their kids. So it would be great if a program like Triple P were widely available. It's cheap. And again, one of the things that in writing this book that I was trying to do was to develop, you know, a model, a system that would provide for all kids what you'd want for your own kid. And that's the one big idea of Kids First. It's the golden rule applied for policy. Whatever you want for a child you love, that's what you would want for your own kid. And it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, trips to Europe to go looking at the castles or an internship with your congressman, but it means solid experiences for parents and for kids from birth all the way through high school and beyond. And it's in that sense, you know, that programs like Triple P, Positive Parenting Program, or really good early education makes sense, because they're not wildly expensive. Preschool is not really more expensive, interestingly, than good K through 12 education. Parenting programs that help people who are helping parents do a better job, those are also not expensive programs. But, you know, just getting across the idea that parents need that kind of help, want that kind of help, and frankly, getting parents organized politically so that they demand that kind of help, so they get taken as seriously as seniors do, that's a crucial part of the story.
We're at a midpoint here in this hour of Focus. Let me again introduce the guest, David Kirp. He's professor and former acting dean at the Goldman School of Public Policy at University of California, Berkeley. 2008, he served on President Obama's transition team. Before that, he taught at the Harvard Graduate School for Education. He was founding director of the Harvard Center on Law and Education. He is also former associate editor of the Sacramento Bee and a syndicated columnist, and is author of the recent book Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. And Public Affairs Books is the publisher. It's out now. Questions welcome. We have a couple people here who'd like to join in. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we'll go first to Belgium. Line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I'd like to change your topic from preschool and stuff back to something you discussed a bit earlier, and that was No Child Left Behind and Laura and George's idea of how to educate children. And the total failure of it is really a demise for our whole educational system. I know you have some other views about it, but not only does it retard children in their learning because all the teachers teach are just what's on these tests that they have to pass to make sure that their school is not demonized in some sort of way. You know, children right now have no penmanship classes. You know, that, you know, I know everybody uses a computer, but still, you need to know how to write legibly. Nobody ever teaches children the capitals of the states. Well, who needs to know the capitals of states? That's not so important as is to know where the states are at and what your country is really about. You need to know a little geography. They don't teach that anymore. And then the worst thing about it is the teachers themselves are now put in a position where the only thing they do is go after these tests. They don't teach what they wanted to do. They're not teachers like they were. They're just proctors, essentially, anymore. And it's forcing teachers to be less and less capable. And you really kind of glossed over the topic of that really detrimental aspect to our educational system.
You know, I agree with you entirely. And again, I've not written a book about No Child Left Behind. I've written a book that talks about parenting support, early education, why you want to link good schools with their communities, why you want to get a caring, stable adult, a mentor into the lives of children, and why you want to assure kids a nest egg. And the reason that in the middle of that there's the sentence, strong, good schools, and I'm not spending a book's length of time writing about it, is that so much ink has been spilled on that topic. Now, on the merits, I agree with you entirely, and I'd point you to a book by Diane Ravitch called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, which really, you know, underscores the point you're making. All I wanted to say, and I'm hanging out in an urban school, you know, I see what happens when teachers are pushed to teach to the test and the narrowness of the test. On the other hand, I want to say that, you know, before No Child Left Behind, in too many schools with poor kids in them and poor minority kids in them, you know, there was a sense that you give up on these kids. What can you expect? They're not going to do well. I hope that when the major educational legislation, what's called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, gets renewed this year, and there are still hopes that it will be the one serious piece of bipartisan legislation that emerges from this Congress, that the kind of concerns you're raising will be addressed, and that there not just be this relentless focus on literacy and numeracy. You mentioned geography. The subject that really concerns me is science, which, you know, similarly is not being taught. So New York City, which has prided itself on how well its kids are doing on tests recently, the eighth graders in New York City took the new science test. Well, guess what? 13% of them were proficient. That means, 87% not proficient. And that's no surprise because they're not learning science. So I'm not a defender by any means of No Child Left Behind as it stands. I am a defender of pushing school systems to find ways they can to get kids to think and reason effectively, and really an advocate of finding ways to connect schools to their communities so that they're not just focused on the narrow three R's, but really do address a whole array of skills and needs that kids have.
Well, I want to thank the caller, and I have some others. Just real quick, do you want to talk just a little bit more about that idea, because that is indeed another of your five ideas about linking schools and communities?
I do, and it's interesting that almost, you know, almost willy-nilly, we're working our way up the age ladder here, from parenting support to good early education to linking schools and communities. And let me say this about sort of what are called community schools, and that is all they are. They take the principles of really good early education, in which school is not just about academics. It's about a whole array of activities, things we would, you know, learning through art and through music and through science experiments, and believe me, there are science experiments that go on in preschool, and bringing sort of after-school support, before-school support, and healthcare into the environment of the school. All of those core principles, not just open, you know, 5 days a week necessarily, 180 days a year, but open year-round and maybe open on Saturdays as well. Taking those principles and making them part of the system, they connect parents and so do community schools. So. And interestingly, this model of the school which breaks down the old 180-day, you know, 8-to-3 school day and really supports academics and supports other forms of learning and fun 6 days a week, sunrise to sunset, 12 months a year, that model with health care connected to the school so that you've got eye exams in the school and you've got hearing exams in the school and you've got dental exams in the school to deal with the huge problems that kids, middle-class kids as well as poor kids, carry around with them. That you give parents something that they can engage in the school. If there are GED classes, there are citizenship classes, there are ESL classes in those schools so that parents can learn English and can walk down the pathway to citizenship and get their high school diplomas. Those kinds of activities, that model of a school, isn't something I invented. It's something that Arnie Duncan, when he was in Chicago as the head of the Chicago schools, really embraced. There are 150-plus community schools in Chicago, a model that was spearheaded by Arnie Duncan. And my fond hope is that now, as Secretary of Education, he goes from focusing on that academically rigorous core and broadening it, as I said, to include things like science and social studies, the subjects that the last caller was raising. He broadened that model to incorporate the kinds of concerns for the child, not just the brain of the child, but the child more generally, that the community school represents, that he encouraged those kinds of activities that really allow kids to navigate in the world and to be strong, confident citizens, not just citizens who are narrowly proficient in reading and math.
All right. Let's talk with some other listeners. And Peoria is the next person here in line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I don't remember where I heard that at least some states predict their prison population by looking at the number of third graders that cannot read at an acceptable level. If that is true, and maybe you can tell me if you ever heard that as well, isn't cutting early childhood education a way of shooting our budget in the foot 10 years down the road?
Couldn't have said it better. Absolutely. What we know about being able to read by the end of third grade is that those kids who can't read at that point are far more likely to be left back, far more likely to drop out, and we know that dropouts are far more likely to wind up in the prison system. You know, flipping it around, we also know that kids who graduate from high school and go on to college and get meaningful degrees are going to be, you know, real contributors to the economy and real contributors to the Commonwealth as well. They're going to be active, involved, engage thoughtful citizens, and that's important as well. So building from parents to preschool to strong early education is critical. There's a new, encouragingly, and David asked early on about sort of, is there anything good happening out there in the world, which is a very fair question these days. Encouragingly, 75 foundations have come together to join forces in a campaign for, you know, reading at grade level by age 9, which is the end of third grade. To get 75 foundations to work and play well together is itself a huge task. And if it really happens, that's a spectacular sort of shot in the arm investment in a campaign to change the conversation. So, you know, I wish more politicians were not as short-sighted as they were, and I wish they took heed of your message about, you know, why it is that you don't. You really are, as you say, you're eating your seed corn, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You pick the metaphor, but that down the road we're going to pay for this in terms of America's economic advantage, America's political stability, and America's prison population.
And why aren't there people in state capitals and federal capitals arguing against budget cuts at this point, saying that isn't a budget cut, it's not a money saver, we cannot afford to not educate our children at a very early age?
You know, it's a mystery to me. I think, but then again, how it is that somebody someday will write that definitive history that explains how we got from November 2008, you know, and our faith in a transformative moment in American politics, you know, to where we were 2 years later, you know, when we've turned the keys of government over to the people who got us in this situation in the first place. There are now proposed classes in New York City with 60 students in a class. 60. That's back to the 19th century method of, you know, there's not a teacher in the front of the room teaching all the class, but the teacher is teaching senior students who is teaching younger students who are teaching younger students.
Yes, my mother came from England in the 1920s and was first in her class of 63 students.
Yep. In fact, the method was called the Lancaster method. So that's exactly where it comes from. And preschool, you know, I've been to Texas, where, you know, I saw one preschool teacher presiding over 35 3-year-olds. Well, that's not good for anybody. It certainly isn't good for the kids. You're not going to get, you know, if anything, the kids are going to have to learn to be aggressive, to be survivors in that kind of a world. So short-sighted indeed we are. And I'd point to the, you know, I would hope the politicians might just look across the seas to England, a country that, you know, for which we profess a continuing fondness. Because when the Tory government was elected in 2010, it really took seriously budget cuts across the board. And having done so, it preserved its commitment to not increase the number of kids who are raised in poverty, and it added money to support early education for poor and otherwise at-risk kids who are 2 years old. So it expanded the system. And this, by the way, it's not as though nobody is speaking out for this. In the face of all these budget cuts, if you listen to the President's State of the Union address, you know, over and over again he hammered on the importance of education, and he's clearly prepared to fight for education. Now, what happens down the road? Who knows? You know, my prayer is that in a state like Wisconsin or Indiana or Ohio, that in those states where there really are attacks on the education system, that the matter go to the voters, and the voters speak out and say, no, this is not what we want. This is not the kind of future that we want for our kids, because I don't see any other way for the moment of turning around this anti-youth, anti-child, anti-education agenda that these politicians are bringing, this hostile to teachers, hostile to anybody who works with kids agenda.
I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left in this hour. Just very quickly introduce again our guest, David Kerp. He is professor and former acting dean at the Goldman School of Public Policy at University of California, Berkeley, and author of the recent book, Kids First, Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives and America's Future. We have some other callers here. Next, we have someone in Fairbury on line number 2. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Yes.
Thanks for the interesting topic. You picked a great time because ISATs are being done this week in Illinois, and as a husband of a early childhood teacher and kindergarten teacher, I can't support your sentiments enough. But I have a couple of things that the other thing is that school board members and administrators need to be listening to this, and you could probably do weeks of these kind of program. One of the problems my wife sees and is imparted on me is that it seems like we have more and more paper shuffling and administration talking about these issues and not enough troops on the ground, so to speak. Wondered if you'd care to comment on that. And then the other thing, your quote about the soft bigotry of low expectations, just because you live in a rural area or part of a city or something, it seems like you get two different educations. And wondered if you could comment on those things.
Well, I think I want to say a lot about first. First of all, I appreciate the good words, especially coming from someone who's living with the kind of person who really is my hero. And if you guys read Kids First, I'd love to know what you think of it. You can find me at kirp@berkeley.edu. But troops on the ground is exactly right in two senses. We need to respect the people who work with little kids more than we do. We need to make sure that preschool teachers are paid what K-12 teachers are paid. We need to give the folks that we call child care workers a really interesting phrase. We don't talk about anybody as a worker in the society anymore. We need to give those folks a living wage so that they're paid more than the folks who flip burgers at McDonald's. And we need to push politically to get lawmakers to pay attention. I mean, why is it that seniors, get 7 times more money per senior spent on them than kids? Because they're really well organized and because they have a very coherent agenda, right? Medicare, Social Security, prescription drugs. The kids' lobby is disorganized, fragmented. Parents, are understandably busy with their kids, but all those folks who are working with kids and who are teaching kids and all those grandparents who see the importance of early education with their kids need to come together, need to join forces, need to be lobbying, need to be pressuring their legislators, need to be targeting for defeat lawmakers who really are anti-kid. So I want to underscore the importance of that. And yes, I think you're absolutely right about rural school districts. We pay much too little attention to them. Lots of strengths that living, a rural life brings to kids. Lots more self-reliance, lots more opportunities to do things, to be leaders. And we need to capitalize on that. And schools of education and schools that prepare people to work in child caring professions need to understand the differences between lives in big cities, suburbs, and rural locations. So I really appreciate the call.
All right.
Thank you again.
I want to thank the caller and to go on to the next. And this is someone in Urbana in line 3. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I very much agreed with most of what you've said. I think we need to broaden the discussion a bit, though. It seems to me there are outside policies which we've enacted over the last 20 or 30 years that very much influence education, particularly for low-income people. And in particular, I don't think welfare reform was reform. Forcing a mother to take a low-pay job and put her children into low-quality daycare seems to me entirely counterproductive. I'm old enough that I remember when I was drafted into the Army meeting people who came out of that social strata, something that most of us middle-class people have never had the opportunity to do. And my impression from what these people said, and I got to know some of them very well, was that their mothers were the only truly beneficial influence they had, and that they often were very effective. And it seems to me that the so-called welfare reform was very counterproductive. It no longer allowed them to have this beneficial influence, particularly for the first 6-10 years.
I would say in the long run, we as a society have to revisit some of the basic structural changes that we've wrought over time. And certainly aspects of welfare reform are important. We would do so well if we would enable moms to stay home for the first at least 3 to 6 months with their kids and support them for doing so, not just allow them, but provide them the resources. We're the only country among our economic peers that doesn't do that. But until we tackle the big ticket items, until we tackle Social Security and Medicare, we really are nibbling at the edges. There are lots of worthy social enterprises that are suffering. You know, even as the president was supporting increases in early education, he was cutting funding for supplements to home heating oil budgets. That means that people in states like Illinois, poor people, are going to really suffer for that. So we've got to tackle those issues, and I think it's really important that all the folks who are in the child-serving business recognize that it's not only arguing for the cause of children, it's arguing for making children a priority, even if that means cutting elsewhere. And Lord help us, it means that we need to acknowledge the fact that the government does useful things and it needs money to do so, and that may mean increasing taxes in some cases.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. To Atlanta, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Great conversation, and I agree with, education is, probably the thing that could probably save us all. And the one point you've touched on a little bit that I would like to bring up, that education has to be broad-based, particularly at a younger age like that. I think maybe 10 years ago, I'm not familiar with young kids right now, so I don't know whether it's still true or not, but at one time we were doing a lot of, in really young kids, teaching them environmental type things, how to live your life that was friendly to the earth and where you fit in. Nutrition, that's got to be one of the really big important things, is to teach young kids about nutrition and health. And I think we're on the right track, but I think our curricula, science is important. We have to have a science-based society. There's no doubt about it. But we also have to live a life that is friendly to the planet, and starting with young kids and teaching that, I think, is one of the most important things we can possibly do in education. So, thanks.
No, I think that, that's, again, what I want to say. The very best education doesn't give up on the central importance of learning how to read and write and think and do math. But there's no reason why that has to be done in a vacuum. Science, environment, health, the arts, history, geography, those are all subjects that require that you know how to read, write, and think, and do sums, and do pretty complicated math as well. So I'm hoping that that there isn't a war between these activities, and people see them as all part of the piece, and that if you develop a curriculum that integrates them, kids are going to be a whole lot more excited than a curriculum that is relentlessly focused on, skill and drill for vocabulary and basic comprehension.
One other thing I want to make sure that we talk about before we're out of time here, we have a couple minutes left, is paying for college. I get the chance from time to time doing this to talk with some of our top administrators, and I think almost every time I ask one of the questions I ask is, what are we doing about the ever-increasing cost of a college education? You've proposed something that would say to people, yes, we expect you to pay for part of it. We expect you to start thinking about that early, and we expect you to save. But we're not saying to them, we're also expecting you to pay the entire cost out of your pocket.
No, that's right. And I the last of the items on the agenda, I don't want to leave the importance of having a mentor in kids' lives, because when I ask people in the field, what's the most important thing you could do for a child?
Uh-huh.
It's getting a stable, caring adult to help kids through the shoals of adolescence. But beyond that, a lot of kids are going to get to the end of high school, they're going to have done just fine, but they don't have the resources, don't think they have the resources to go to college. And creating a kiddie savings account, which the government invests something at birth, and parents keep investing along the way, and for poor parents, those investments are matched by the government, does two things. It gives the kids a nest egg, but at least as importantly, it gets poor families and working class families thinking about what the future is like, and it gets those kids thinking about what the future is like, because they get those statements in the mail that say, here's what your account has done, and that makes them more money savvy and it makes them more future conscious. So that's the last step in the process. You build on kids who are smart and aware and able to connect to the larger universe, and then you give them the resources to take the next step.
Yeah. Just to come back to something an earlier caller said, I guess I also think that one has to, when you make the arguments that you have and you say these are the kind of programs that we should be doing, I think any time that you talk to somebody who talks about health care or public education or support for families and they talk to lawmakers, I'm sure often they hear this thing about, well, that'd be really nice, but we can't afford that. And I think you made the point, an earlier caller made the point, that what you have to do is make the counter argument that says, look, you're going to pay one way or another. You can either pay now or you can pay later. And if you wait and pay later, the bill is probably going to be much more. I think that that makes a really good argument, but I'm not sure how often lawmakers are actually persuaded by that.
Well, the only lawmakers are persuaded by voters. And the classic line is kids don't matter because kids don't vote. They don't vote, but parents vote, and all the folks who work with kids vote, and they're a huge chunk of the economy. The child economy, it's all the money publicly and privately invested in kids, is way bigger than the financial services sector. It's about one-sixth of the gross national product. If those folks saw themselves as a sector, the way the financial services people see themselves as a sector, the political conversation would be very, very different indeed.
Well, there we will finish with our thanks to our guest, David Kirp. He's professor, former acting dean at the Goldman School of Public Policy at University of California, Berkeley. If you want to read more of his thinking on the subject, you look for his book, Kids First. The subtitle is Five Big Ideas for Transforming Children's Lives in America's Future. Public Affairs is the publisher. And Professor Kirp, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Take care.